From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the former head of the FBI Serial Crime Unit, John Douglas, returns to talk with us about profiling and pursuing predatory criminals, rapists, stalkers, and child molesters. Douglas developed the technique of profiling to probe the minds of dangerous violent criminals and to better understand what triggers their violent behavior. Also, goodbye to the king of one-liners. We remember comedian Henny Youngman, who died yesterday at the age of 91. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new box set of rare recordings by Rahsaan Roland Kirk. And TV critic David Biancooley tells us about two new shows starring Anne Margaret and Tom Selleck. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. About 500 residents of California's San Joaquin Valley hope to go home today. People from the town of Early Mart were forced out because of a flash flood. High water has also closed one of California's major north-south highways. Steve Kruger of member station KPLU reports.
A quarter-mile section of the White River broke through its banks after heavy El Niño-driven rains soaked the Sierra Nevada foothills east of Early Mart. Floodwaters as much as 4 feet deep now cover the town. Most residents left voluntarily before the flood hit, after police and fire crews sounded the alarm just before midnight Tuesday. The flood has also closed U.S. 99, a busy main highway that connects Northern California to Los Angeles. The highway isn't expected to reopen until the weekend. There is a little good news ahead for the evacuees. The weather forecast calls for sunshine and no rain for at least 5 days. But residents are worried that a deep mountain snowpack could cause more flooding when it melts later this spring. For NPR News, I'm Steve Kruger near Early Mart, California.
President Clinton is surveying tornado damage in Florida at this hour. The central part of the state was ravaged by a series of tornadoes earlier this week that killed at least 39 people. The death toll is higher than the one recorded during Hurricane Andrew. Three people are still missing and hundreds of buildings were damaged. South Korea's former leading dissident is now its president. Kim Dae-jung took office during a ceremony that included a 21-gun salute and the release of 1,500 doves of peace. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The band played Bridge Over Troubled Water as Kim Dae-jung completed a personal odyssey that has taken him from political prisoner to the highest office in his land. Among the thousands who gathered under cobalt blue skies, former presidents Chun Doo-hwan and No Tae-woo, the two ex-generals orchestrated a political crackdown 18 years ago that left hundreds dead and Kim Dae-jung condemned to death. But there were no words of recrimination. The 74-year-old dissident-turned-commander-in-chief called for reconciliation and economic revival. He thanked the United States and the IMF for its economic assistance. The crowd cheered when Kim proposed peacemaking with North Korea and yelled even louder when their new president plunged into a sea of well-wishers. For the first time in their history, citizens were able to approach the inaugural podium unfettered by police. This is Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Tokyo.
New York Representative Bill Paxon is leaving Congress. He sent a letter to his Republican colleague saying it's the toughest decision he's made. The decision comes 7 months after he was forced out of House GOP leadership. He'd helped lead a failed coup against House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Paxon's retirement ends a possible race for another House leadership position that could have revealed a schism within Republican lawmakers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up 72 points at 84.42. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is rebounding from yesterday's drop in record levels. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The advance has been helped in part by the stability of Treasury bonds, which are steady after Fed Chairman Greenspan implied that interest rate policy is on hold until the impact of the Asian financial crisis becomes more clear. The market is also being supported by overnight gains in the major equity markets in Europe and Asia. Drug stocks are higher after Pfizer was reinstated buy at ABN AMRO. Diversified healthcare issues are up after American Home Products was added to the priority list at Goldman Sachs. And airline shares are advancing after Japan Airlines and American announced a marketing partnership. I'm Doug Krisner.
The Supreme Court has narrowly ruled in favor of banks in their closely watched fight with credit unions over new members. The justices ruled 5-4 the government has wrongly allowed credit unions to enroll new clients who should not have qualified for membership. It overturns a 15-year-old government policy that allowed credit unions to accept millions of new members from outside traditional membership pools. However, a new federal law is being introduced retroactively allowing this practice. Credit unions offer many of the same services that banks do, but the credit unions can make better deals on loans and savings because they don't pay federal taxes. California farmers have been badly affected by El Niño storms. The farm industry estimates at least one quarter of the current asparagus crop could be lost to disease because of the excess rain. An artichoke industry official predicts his crop will also likely be hurt this season. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. John Douglas knows the criminal mind. He was the founder and head of the FBI Special Investigative Unit and is one of the country's leading criminal profilers. He examines all the evidence from a crime scene and constructs a personality profile of the suspect, from their upbringing to the type of car they drive. He was the model for the character Special Agent Jack Crawford in Jonathan Demme's film Silence of the Lambs. While he still works as a profiler, Douglas retired a few years ago from the FBI after more than 25 years. Douglas has been called in to investigate many high-profile cases and has interviewed Charles Manson, Richard Speck, David Berkowitz, also known as Son of Sam, and Ted Bundy. John Douglas has co-authored a number of books about his work, and his latest is called Obsession, and is about predatory killers, rapists, and stalkers. Their goal, he says, is manipulation, domination, and control. I asked Douglas how he goes about constructing a criminal profile.
This is very different than the show Millennium or the show Profiler, where they seem to have an out-of-body experience. You know, sometimes people think that I must have had this. You know, when I come up with some sometimes very detailed and specific characteristics. But the first thing is you have to go into the went into the penitentiaries to really interview the experts, the people who perpetrate the crimes, the rapists, the murderers, from a law enforcement investigative perspective, not from the perspective of rehabilitation. I just totally don't believe in it, particularly with sexual predators. So, in essence, I walk in their shoes to get a feel and understanding for them.
What do you ask them? What do you want to know from a predatory criminal?
Okay. What I'd like to know from a child molester, abductor, is, okay, why do you go into a shopping center looking for children? And they said, well, today the trend is for parents are dropping their kids off at these shopping centers, particularly at the toy stores and particularly at the video arcades. Okay, then what are you looking for? I says, well, I can spot the child like the lion on a Serengeti plain, the child that is not being well cared for, that has low self-esteem. When you look in their eyes, the eyes appear to be vacant. The child is physically, the clothes aren't well taken care of and cared for. And what do you do? Then he says, I go up to the child and I offer tokens to play the games in the video arcade. And at some point, I will actually physically touch the child and to see touching the child, just even on the shoulder. And if the child is okay with that, then I proceed and get friendly with the child, and then I'll develop a ruse or con to get that child out of that store. And then once they get the child out of the store, it may end into sexual assault and homicide. Then I want to know, you know, why did you kill the child? Why did you select this disposal site over another? And also, did you follow the press? I'm asking questions that I'm looking for patterns that I can apply.
I'm curious how you conduct an interview like that. If you're dealing with someone who is a repeat offender, a predatory sex offender, what do you do to show them that you're, in a sense, in control and command of this situation? Yeah. Are there certain things you'll put on the table to disarm them, to unnerve them, or No. Or how much are you looking for their body language?
Yeah, okay. It is. In fact, it's in a way, it's kind of the opposite. I have to let them be in control let them manipulate and dominate and let them think that they're controlling me, but I'm letting them do that. If they want to sit up on top of a chair to be above me, to have eye contact above me, yeah, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. But I really have to stroke their egos. And I found it was very effective to do nighttime interviews versus daytime interviews. They felt very much more at ease and comfortable. And the thing about it was is that they never had anyone to talk to who knew their crime, who looked at the case, who looked at the crime scene photographs. Because if I did see something where they were starting to lie to me, like they will do, they'll test you. And I'll say, hey, knock off the BS here. I said, I've seen the crime scene photographs. I've known what you do. I don't care about that. But gosh, you're good. You know, how are you able to elude us? Did you follow the press? Did you respond when the police chief said, you know, we have no new leads? So when I get through this with them, they don't want you to leave. They want to spend hours with you. They want you to come back. They get off on it. I'm there. My mission is to get information. People think, well, gee, you're just as bad as they are. No, if you asked me after the interview, would you pull the switch on these guys? The answer is yes, I would volunteer to pull the switch. I have no care or concern for these people.
When you're talking about predatory criminals, does someone develop their particular modus operandi, that they have a certain way that they're going to either select the person that they're going to kill or kill them the way that they kill, or perhaps even leave the crime scene in a certain kind of way, a way that you can connect it?
Right. It all starts with fantasy with these people. And oftentimes the fantasy starts way early in adolescence. And the fantasy is interesting. In their mind, there's a preferential victim. The way this victim should look, the way they think the victim is going to react when confronted by the subject. But interesting enough, when you start linking cases together where you see victims that are dissimilar, that doesn't mean that you have multiple offenders. If the person is after a particular age group or particularly look of a woman, say a blonde, 30 years of age, if he cannot find that victim, he will not bypass a brunette who's 50 years of age. So, and the other thing is on the modus operandi is if you don't catch him early enough, the modus operandi is perfected. And they get better at it. That's right. They get better and better at what they do. But the way you link cases together, if you possibly can, is to look for a signature, the signature. And the signature is something that the subject does that is unnecessary to perpetrate the crime. To give an example, it could be torture. Stephen Pinnell in Delaware tortured his victims. There was evidence of torture. A guy by the name of George Russell in the state of Washington, he would pose his victims after death. In the case of rape, where officers sometimes they don't ask the right questions, by eliciting responses from the victim regarding the verbal, the sexual, and the physical assault, we're able to determine what the signature was. And the signature may be just the subject's into degrading of the victim, or he's sadistic with this victim, which is really unnecessary.
You call these interpersonal crimes, that they involve a very intense kind of relationship.
Right.
If you're looking at the perpetrators of these crimes and you're going back to their childhoods, kind of piecing together what their early family life was about, are there some connections there? Do you see that there were signs of, what, abuse or neglect, something within the family?
You do see that, but you can't make the quantum leap and say that everyone who's the victim of a child abuse or neglect is going to turn out to be a serial murderer or, oftentimes with women, prostitution or turn to drugs. But of the violent offenders who I've interviewed, who I've researched, almost without exception, you do see this dysfunction. You see animal cruelty. You see enuresis, which is bedwetting, and you also see evidence of arson. Fire setting. We call that the homicidal triangle. And people will come up to me, particularly school teachers. They say, we're seeing these characteristics now. This student who is just anti everything, anti authority, who is the bully in the class, and just has this meanness, this streak. But they feel helpless because they have to put this child at the end of the day back into that dysfunctional environment. And people ask me, well, how can you turn it around, the violent trend in this country? Really what you'd have to do is to have the kind of monies that we put out in the Persian Gulf War commitment and personnel, millions of dollars, maybe billions, and provide loving, nurturing homes for these children, taken out of this violent environment, and you can change the cycle. But the way things are going, it's not going to change.
Can they compartmentalize their life to the point where they can have a family, a job, be looked upon as a good neighbor?
Oh, sure. I had a case in Alaska where I was sent up there, where there was a suspect. I did an assessment of a suspect. He was a baker in the community, and looking at him, he did have some very low self-esteem. He had a speech impediment. I think that hurt him and caused him to fuel the low self-esteem. But here was a guy who would, when his wife was away and he had a daughter, he would go on the strip picking up women, prostitutes. He would take them back to his house for 3 or 4 days where he would torture them sexually and physically. He then would take them out to his airplane. He would fly these women up into the wilderness upstate in Alaska, land his aircraft on a frozen lake, take the women out of the airplane, strip them down and hunt them down like a wild animal. Now here's a guy. This guy looked like Harvey Milquetoast when you would see him. People say he doesn't look like a serial killer, and that's the problem. What does a serial killer look like? They don't have a third eye. There's not an X on their forehead. There are different types of men who commit these types of crime.
You talk about 4 different kinds of rapists, and perhaps you can give us a quick thumbnail sketch, a profile of these 4 different kinds of rapists.
Yeah. Okay. The there's 4 types. They all center around anger and power. The most common one that in this country that makes up about 80% of the rapists is what we call the power reassurance rapist. He's also known as the gentleman rapist. It's a misnomer, but it's the gentleman rapist. And the reason for that is during the actual assault, once he has the victim under control, He's trying to make the attack pleasurable for the woman. We call him the unselfish rapist. And he's asking questions about the victim's personal life, her sexual history. He's apologetic. He's generally someone who lives in your immediate vicinity.
But is he sincere?
He is, at that time, he is. There's some sincerity there, and that's why he may hang around. He doesn't want you to see him, so he'll come in either wearing a face mask, or if he doesn't wear a face mask, he'll put a pillowcase or pillow over the victim's face. And please, as women, don't look at him. If he says, don't look at me, you do not look at him. And if he's trying to engage in conversation, what you have to do is survival identification. Mm-hmm. You really should personalize yourself and engage in conversation back with this individual. Really, unfortunately, if you wake up with a knife at your throat, you're really looking for survival here. If you yell or scream, you could get yourself killed. I mean, this person will kill you if it looks like he may get caught. So you have to be careful. And this is the kind of guy too who may be doing work around your house or in your apartment, and he gathers intelligence information on you. The exploitive kind of a rapist, he is the type who will you go into a particular store, and the woman behind the counter says, it's a robbery. He says, oh, please, I'll do anything you say. Please don't hurt me. And the lights go on. He ends up taking advantage of her, and he ends up raping her. And then there's this anger retaliatory. That person is generally married. He's in a relationship with a woman, a girlfriend, wife. And there's a falling out here. But rather than strike out at the wife or the girlfriend, he goes on the hunt looking for a victim where he can dish it out. And he's pretty vicious, and those kind of cases could, in fact, lead to homicide.
Hmm.
The worst, and they're all bad, but then the worst one that does oftentimes evolve into homicide is a sadistic serial rapist. Because no matter what the victim does, no matter what the victim says, please don't hurt me, I'll do anything you say, their goal and their strategy is to put the fear of God in this woman and to punish the victim. Some of these people go so far as to even make audio tapes of the actual assault, of the actual torture.
Well, these are 4 types of rapists, but I'm, if God forbid you're in a situation like this and you're being raped or being victimized with the threat of rape, you don't have a lot of time to kind of figure out, well, who the heck am I dealing with?
You can't say that. You're right. You can't say, well, I'm going to turn to page 32 here.
But what do you suggest? That people be cooperative, that no matter what the person says, that you comply?
It depends where you are. A lot of my colleagues don't like to give that information out. I disagree. For example, if it's an outdoor case in that shopping center, or it's someone flags you down like there's something wrong with your vehicle, you don't ever want to get in that person's car. Now, if this person confronts you in a parking lot and has a knife, I'd rather see the victim stabbed than to get into, and fighting and screaming and yelling, than to get into that vehicle, because now you can you're a threat. You can easily identify this person. You can identify his vehicle. And the probabilities in that kind of a scenario is this person has a criminal history, and he's probably done similar crimes in the past. And so he knows that, you know, dead people tell no tales. So you'll probably will lose your life. The other, if you still don't have a chance and you're taken away with that type of person, you really have to, again, personalize yourself and even make up things if you have to. And maybe you'll be able to touch a soft spot about maybe you have an illness maybe your child is sick. I saw one case, just so I give an example, one woman who, in fact, was a prostitute, and she thought she could make it pleasurable for the guy. Well, the guy who was raping her just broke up with his girlfriend who was cheating on him. So he was out. He was a serial rapist. And so by her saying, gee, this is very good, you're great, and kind of have a date with you in the future, in his mind now, he said, John, he says, just told me that all women are nothing but whores. Mm-hmm. So now it became mm-hmm. easier for him to kill this victim. So you have to, you have to rely on your instincts and your gut reaction, which in a matter of seconds you have to make this decision.
We'll talk more with criminal profiler John Douglas after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Criminal profiler John Douglas is our guest. We're talking about getting inside the mind of predatory criminals, which is the subject of his new book, Obsession. Let me talk to you a little bit about stalker profiles. And you describe the relationship between the stalker and the person that is being stalked. But let's talk about these two different profiles, the love obsession and the simple obsession. What's the love obsession?
The love obsession is the type of stalker that we read about a case every 2 or 3 years, such as we have right now, Steven Spielberg. He was stalked by a man who wanted to sexually assault him and kill him, or Madonna, or the Chapman who stalked the Beatles, John Lennon.
John Lennon, yes.
And so those persons are really asocial, isolated individuals whose fantasies and relationship, probably with the TV, is greater than it is with other people. But they reach a point in their lives where they feel the only way to gain recognition or attention is to become part of that particular person, even though the way to become part of that person is to kill the celebrity. And so there's no plan as far as escape. Once they kill the celebrity, it's all over with. But it generally, and that's why you have to be careful with the celebrities. There's generally, these people will start writing letters. You have to warn the celebrities. It's probably not a good idea anymore to send photographs out, answer letters. Because once if you write a letter or two answering this letter, then you stop. Then there's this anger and this hatred. And I'm not going to say that there's thousands of people like that, but there's certainly enough of them where it should be a concern for the celebrity.
But the stalker under this kind of love obsession, they don't know this person,
right,
but they both love them and hate them. I mean, there's something about them that has kind of mesmerized, I guess, the stalker. But then there's the other part of,
because they're delusional. They have this highly systematized delusional system. You'll find when you do searches, you'll find they have scrapbooks of photographs and newspaper articles. And when you're assessing a potential threat, you have to see whether or not this person, say the person is in Philadelphia, now the celebrity is coming to Philadelphia, you should be on high alert, because this person now will probably try to get close to you and may attempt to assault that celebrity.
Well, what about the simple obsession stalker?
Okay, now that's the person. That could be you or I. And at any given moment in this country, there are over 200,000 people who are being stalked. It's an unbelievable statistic. In fact, by the end of the year, there'll be about 1.5 million people will be stalked by someone. And a woman, every woman in this country, 1 out of 20 will be stalked in their lifetime. And there's a very fine line between domestic violence and stalking. And many of these domestic violence cases and these cases we read about every day where there's a homicide slash suicide or just the homicide and the guy ends up surrendering starts off in as a domestic in a domestic relationship where the person is very, very nice initially, showers this woman with gifts and is very, very thoughtful. But then it's very systematic. They end up wanting this woman to have no contact with outside people. They don't want them to work. They want you to cut off any relationships with families.
It's all about control, domination,
that's right,
power.
Definitely, definitely control. The person, the male, has very, very low self-esteem. There may be now actual threats of violence, and the woman will be assaulted. Now, if the woman is assaulted around the face and neck, say slapped or strangled, the chances are now that you're going to be even more brutally attacked in the future is great. In fact, you may even be killed because it's telling me it's a very personal. There's a lot of personal aggression being directed, you know, at you.
Well, talking about interpersonal crimes, and your book is about stalkers and rapists and serial sexual killers. Is there, from your vantage point, is there the possibility of rehabilitation with people like this who commit these kinds of crimes?
Rehabilitation, no, because that, what you're assuming then when they say rehabilitation is that means that they were habilitated to begin with. So how can you rehabilitate somebody who wasn't even normal or correct to begin with?
But what about intensive therapy, behavior modification, even the use of testosterone-lowering drugs, things
like
that?
Yeah, like Depo-Provera that they use at Johns Hopkins University. No, because I've seen cases with that. Again, these are crimes of anger. And I even had the judge want to castrate a rapist in Texas. And hey, judge, this is a crime of anger. I says, you castrate him. I think this could be a pretty angry individual. And if you're using drugs like Depo-Provera or one most recently developed somewhere in Europe this past 2 weeks, what I don't like about it is that they don't really test them. They do an interview and they rely on self-reporting. Well, how do you feel, John? Do you still get this need or urge to go out and molest boys or go and molest the women? Oh no, doc, this stuff is really working. I think if it's young enough, if you're young enough with the therapy, but not if you're already on track and now you're telling me this person's in his 20s, mid-20s, 30s, 40s, it's like you cannot change the sexual preference. You cannot, it'd be like trying to change my sexual preference. It can't be done.
Do people outgrow, though, crimes like this, that if they're kept in prison long enough into, say, their 60s or 70s, chances are that will put a stop to repeat offenders?
Yeah, I mean, if the person is being wheeled around in a wheelchair, that's a problem. But look at the guy who in California, he chopped off the arms of a girl he held hostage, and then they released him, which is unbelievable. He then goes down to Florida, and he's 70-plus something years, and he ends up murdering a woman down there. You see, the psychiatrists and psychologists try to think of that there was a connection between the testosterone and the aggression and the sex, and it has nothing to do with that. This is the anger. This is the domination. This is control.
John Douglas's new book is called Obsession. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Additional support comes from Walker & Company, publisher of Fermat's Enigma, the epic quest to solve the world's greatest mathematical problem by Simon Singh. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember comedian Henny Youngman, who died yesterday at the age of 91. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new box set of rare Rahsaan Roland Kirk recordings. And TV critic David Biancooley reviews new show starring Anne Margaret and Tom Selleck. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. The late Rahsaan Roland Kirk played flute, recorder, piccolo, tenor saxophone, manzello, stritch, clarinet, foot percussion, and various other instruments. He was a jazz man journeyman who was mindful of spirituals, blues, popular classics, and AM radio pop. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Kirk is one of jazz's great absurdists and surrealists. He reviews a new set of mostly rare Kirk recordings, including this 1972 version of Burt Bacharach's I Say a Little Prayer.
Rahsaan Roland Kirk had a contradictory nature. He was a superb soloist who was not always so particular about his rhythm sections. He was a seeming avant-gardist who put down the avant-garde even when that movement was respectable. Since his death 20 years ago, he's been embraced by some critics who see jazz as a refuge for good taste in a vulgar world. But no jazz musician ever stood for bad taste like Rahsaan. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Rahsaan Roland Kirk, 1972. Kirk loved juxtaposing all sorts of material, but there was usually a musical point, or at least musical joke, behind every juxtaposition. You can read the contrasting styles in that last recorder and flute number as a comment on a period fashion for Renaissance instruments among early music experts or English folk singers. Kirk didn't jump cut between styles like a postmodernist. He drifted from one thing to another with the stupid logic of a dream, or Mad Magazine, anyway. All this music comes from a new mini-box of rarities by Rahsaan Roland Kirk called Dog Years in the Fourth Ring. It could all have fit easily on two CDs instead of three, but that's my only complaint. Two discs come from live gigs of the 60s and 70s, and the pieces were selected with care. There are no duds here. The last CD brings back one of Kirk's most intriguing and worst-selling records, Natural Black Inventions, Root Strata, from 1971. Aside from Joe Texidor's rudimentary percussion and a little piano, it was all solo, or duo, since Kirk usually plays two saxes at once. He also uses circular breathing technique so he can play continuously even while inhaling. And he continued to make bizarre but pointed connections. Prelude Back Home exposes George Gershwin's down-home roots by mixing a fragment of one of his piano preludes with old blues licks. Thank you. As Kirk's one-man band routines make clear, one of his inspirations was old Memphis jug bands who played kazoos and washboards on the street, hustling for change. Then or now, that was a part of the Black American musical mosaic lots of jazz fans would rather overlook. Sometimes, when Kirk plays two saxes, he sounds like the late Eddie Harris playing his electric saxophone. Like Kirk, Harris was put down for being lowbrow, especially when he made some bawdy comedy records. Both saxophonists are considered respectable now that they're dead, but it's safe to say some fans still reject part of what each stood for. Yeah, but that's okay. Better to be inconsistent than not to like Rahsaan or Eddie Harris at all.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the new box set Dog Years in the Fourth Ring by Rahsaan Roland Kirk. This is Fresh Air. The entertainment world has lost one of its most original and most imitated comics.
The king of the one-liners, Kenny Youngman.
What a crowd! If I had blood, I'd blush. Downtown, I said to a lady, you know where Michigan Avenue is? She says, yeah. And she walked away. One fellow said, give me $10 till payday. I said, when is payday? He said, you ought to know. You're the one that's working. One fellow said, I haven't eaten in 2 days. I said, you should force yourself. One fellow said, I haven't tasted food all week. I said, don't worry, it tastes the same.
Henny Youngman died yesterday at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Manhattan after a bout with pneumonia. He was 91. For more than six decades, Youngman did it all. Vaudeville, speakeasies, the Borscht Belt, Ed Sullivan, nightclubs, casinos, and sometimes even bar mitzvahs. He never tried to keep up with the times, and there were plenty of periods when younger people thought him hopelessly square. But he'd been Henny Youngman for so long, he was hip. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1991 when he was 85. She started with a question you've got to ask Henny Youngman. How did he come up with his famous one-liner, Take My Wife, Please?
I was on the Kate Smith Show at the time, and my wife came in a half hour before the show. Henny, I need 8 tickets for the show. Luckily, the ushers saved some tickets for me every week. I used to give them $2. That's all I had left. So I got the tickets for Sadie, and I said, take my wife, please. Like, get her out of here. I want her in the audience. And that stuck all these years.
Do you still have jokes in your repertoire that go back to your days in vaudeville?
Sure, I do the same jokes now. I need a new audience, that's all I need. Yeah, I'm always adding.
What are some of the ones that go back to
well, that far? I take my wife everywhere, but she finds a way home. I said, where do you want to go for your anniversary? She said, I want to go somewhere I've never been before. I said, try the kitchen.
Now, how did you start doing, you know, jokes that basically, you know, insult women?
Well, I tell you, they're cute. They're not insults. they're cute, but we have to bounce off somebody, you know. You have to make fun of my brother-in-law. You know how he gets rid of his garbage? He gift-wraps it, leaves it in the car, they steal it. How long are you going to wait to laugh, Terry?
Oh, I had to think that one through
explain,
first.
Yeah, I know it. I got to explain the jokes to you.
Now, there was a time when you were performing at speakeasies for a lot of gangsters in the audience.
Oh, yeah, that was Alito and Venison Patterson. My boys used to stab me good night. The checkroom girl's name was Rocco.
So in that routine, you used to do a lot of insult humor.
Yeah, I do. I always insulted the gangsters. They liked it.
What kinds of jokes?
If you had your life to live over again, don't do it.
Why did gangsters like insult humor so much?
Well, if they like it, they'll take anything from you. If not, you get your head broken somewhere, you know. I heard them plan kidnappings. I kept my mouth shut. I minded my own business. But they let me sit with them all the time. They liked me, luckily.
Did you like them?
Yeah, they weren't bad fellas. All they were murderers and thieves. But around a table, they were nice, you know.
Now, early on in your career, you say you stole jokes. Who'd you steal them
from? I didn't steal them. I took them. I didn't have to steal. They're public domain.
How often have jokes been stolen from you over the years?
Oh, thousands. I put 30 guys in business. When I was on the Kate Smith Show, I had 7 writers. So every week I told 26 jokes that went out in the air. And a lot of comics started from those routines. They couldn't afford writers. They were all amateurs at the time. Buddy Hackett, Jan Murray, Red Buttons, all these guys started in business with my jokes.
What's your most stolen joke?
Take my wife, please. You hear that all over the country.
But everybody knows that's yours.
Yeah.
So
I think I'm associated with it by now.
But what about a joke that's been stolen that people don't realize is
Well,
yours?
I do all the wife jokes and the brother-in-law jokes. They take them every day. A hooker walked up to me. She said, I'll do anything you want for $50. I said, paint my house. That's around the country now. I brought that around, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Henny Youngman.
King of the one-liners.
Yes.
Mention that. That's another thing. Walter Winchell gave me that line.
Yeah, and tell the story of that.
Well, Walter Winchell, I used to sit with him every night. You know, I was starting out, I hung out at Lindy's. I got to know all these columnists, Jack O'Brien, Walter Winchell, Leonard Lyons. And these are the people that used to make you famous. They would put you in their column constantly if they liked you, attached to a joke. And that's how you built a reputation those days. And Walter Winchell gave me a title, King of the One-Liners, and that stuck. So now I got Take My Wife, Please, King of the One-Liners, and Henny, Where's Your Fiddle? I play fiddle.
Now, I'm going to ask you to tell the story of how Ed Sullivan banished you from the show for 5 years.
I had spent $5,000 on new jokes that weekend. I had money to spend. I really wanted to be good, you know. One of those things, you hit the whole network, you want to be good. But I spent $5,000 and gathered a lot of jokes. So I knew them pretty well. I hadn't done them before, but I got him ready to do them that Sunday. He calls me upstairs, take this joke out, take this out, take this out, take this out. I got on stage. I didn't know what I was doing. I really was a mess. He broke up my rhythm. He broke up my routine that I had learned. I came off and I called him a dirty bee. I said, you amateur night son of a bitch. How dare you do this to me? 5 years I was off there.
You write in your book about how you still work the phones all the time. And it sounds like, you know, if you're at the Carnegie Deli, the phone rings for you. In the barber's chair, you're calling.
Wherever
about
it is,
days.
I let people know where I'm at.
Yeah, no.
In case you need me for a job, you know where to get me. My service knows where I am at. I left word when I came at the studio here that I'm here to get my phone calls.
Have you gotten any calls yet?
I don't know. I'm talking to you.
Let's ask Leszek, the engineer. Leszek, has he gotten any phones yet?
Just one.
He's got one phone call already?
Yes.
Who is it from?
It was a gentleman who didn't introduce himself.
Oh, okay. Well, who knows what that's going to be,
yeah,
right?
I get calls all day.
Now, here's what I don't know. Don't you have an agent or something?
Do I have the William Morris Agency.
So what do you have to get the phone calls
because
for?
Because I like to do... Many years ago, I used to call agents to get jobs when I wasn't known. I had to let people know I'm in business. I do sales meetings. I do trade shows. I do conventions. I do outdoor fairs. I do commercials. So I had built up a business before I went with the William Morris office. I let people know where I am, how they can get me. They tell me how much they want to pay me. They send a half a deposit, and I do the job.
Now, you know, I've heard that you have a listed number in the New York directory. So just,
sure, I don't owe any money.
Yeah, so just to test it out, I called New York Information earlier today, and I said to the operator, "Operator, I'd like the number for Henny Youngman in Manhattan." And the operator said, "The Henny Youngman?" And I said, "Yes," and the operator said, "He would not have a listed number." I said, "No, no, but I think he does," and sure enough.
That's astounding, you know, because people think you haven't got a number. That's no good. I want them to know I have a number so they can get to me.
But don't the people who really need to get to you for business reasons know
yes.
how to reach you?
Sure, now they do. You're letting them know.
Now, if I call that up, would I just get an answering machine, or would you
No,
pick
you
it
get
up?
My service.
Oh, I see. Oh, no wonder you could give it out so liberally.
I don't care. As long as I don't owe any money.
Are you doing any topical jokes in
Very
your show
seldom.
Now?
No, not mm-hmm. too many.
You have a great Imelda Marcos one in the book.
Yeah, well, I did it, but she's in Israel planting a shoe tree.
Yeah, I really love that.
Yeah, well, that was topical. It's still good sometimes. But I try to get jokes on a topic at once. Now, I'm just saying, now, Liz Taylor's been married 8 times. She has rice marks on her face. I did that about Zsa Gabor. But now that she's doing it, I use it on her.
Now, do you do all your own jokes now, or do you have writers who are doing them?
No, I haven't. I haven't got a steady job. I don't need writers. I got 2 hours of material in my head. I go out on the stage, I do 40 minutes, 45 minutes.
You're still telling Take My Wife jokes?
All the time.
How do they go over now?
Fine.
Yeah, still in the age of the women's
sure,
movement?
Sure, my wife and I are always holding hands. If I leave, go, she shops.
How did your wife when...
My wife was a pretty woman. She didn't mind what I said about her. She ran after the garbage man. Am I too late for the garbage? She said, no, jump in. My wife didn't know I worked at these gangster places. She would have been frightened. She didn't mind it at all. She didn't know what I was doing. I had conflicts with my wife all the time because my wife was a day person. She wanted me to have a job 9 to 5. I got lucky, and I got in another business which she knew nothing about, and my family resented it. Her family resented it. They thought I was a bum because I hung out at Lindy's till 4 in the morning. They never heard of Lindy's. So I had that to contend with all my life until my wife finally accepted me coming home late at night.
So the marriage withstood both your jokes and your wife's lack of understanding
yeah.
of show
business.
Oh, yeah,
business. Sure. Well, I wouldn't leave my family. I wouldn't leave them. And she wouldn't leave me. Where would she go? She had 2 kids, you know. So we had a lot of fights and arguments over these things. Making people understand what you're doing is very tough,
mm-hmm.
especially when in my business.
Now, what about your parents? Did they ever understand?
No. How would they understand? I was playing people. If I didn't take them to New York, I don't think they would have gone. They lived in Brooklyn.
No, you got thrown out of high school, right?
I was asked to leave, yeah.
What for?
Telling jokes or breaking up the class. Teacher thought I was a nuisance. He could have laughed, but he was an idiot, I guess.
So when you were thrown out of high school, what did you do next?
My father made me learn a trade, printing. I went to Brooklyn Vocational Trade School.
So how did you go from, you know,
I don't know.
Trade school and all this
I had
to,
a band.
I was,
my father made me study fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
My mother.
Well, they wanted
my aunt gave me a fiddle. Her son didn't want it.
They wanted you to be a great classical violinist.
Right, sure. I studied 7 years. And we had a comedy band like Spike Jones. And one night, an act didn't show up, so the boy said, Henny, you know a lot of jokes. You got to save my life. I got a banquet out there. I went on. I told all my jokes. I did a half hour. I was a riot, really. I had a lot of funny stuff. He said, let the band go, will you? I'll keep you. So I became a comedian.
And when you were getting started and you were trying to, you know, convince people to hire you, where would you go?
Well, I went around all the agents in New York. There were booking agents.
Uh-huh.
There were buildings that had booking agent on the door. So I'd walk in and introduce myself. Some of them used me, found out it was funny, and that was it. I got around. I got jobs here and there. Got jobs with the fiddle. I got jobs telling jokes.
Would you have to do shtick for the booking agents in their office?
Well, I used to come in. I usually come in with a joke of the day. I used to find a joke and tell it to them. They laughed at me, and they got to like me, you know. You got to prove you're a comedian. You can say it, but you got to prove it.
You know, a lot of interviewers like to ask the tombstone question, what would you like written on your tombstone? I myself never asked this question, but to you, I'm just curious if you want a one-liner on yours.
Well, I really never figured that out, honestly. When I lost my wife, I used to say, take my wife, please. That's the one time I didn't want to say it.
Yeah.
I'll have to figure that out. What to say on there? Leave him laughing. Ha, ha, ha.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you. When you come to New York, call me. Take my number.
Please.
Please. I'll take you to the Friars for lunch.
Oh, boy, I'd really love that.
Yeah, you might enjoy it. Hey, Terry, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, and
it's
I wish
a pleasure,
you the best.
Really.
Henny Youngman spoke with Terry Gross in 1991. He died yesterday in Manhattan. He was 91 years old. Coming up, David Biancooley tells us about two new TV shows. This is Fresh Air. During its coverage of the Winter Olympic Games, CBS devoted a lot of airtime and energy to promoting new series that it would launch when the Olympics were over, especially a new sitcom starring Tom Selleck and a new drama starring Anne Margaret. Well, those series have arrived, and TV critic David Biancooley has this review.
The reason I waited until today to present this report is that the Anne Margaret series, Four Corners, wasn't available for preview and didn't premiere until last night. So now I can look at Four Corners and the Selleck series The Closer, which premiered Monday night, and render the same verdict. Good stars, good casts, not so good scripts. Frankly, I don't really understand it. Tom Selleck is such a popular and likable actor, and did so well at comedy in his guest role on Friends and his supporting role in the movie In and Out, that putting him in a sitcom of his own should be a fail-safe proposition. That's especially true when the supporting cast includes talent like Ed Asner, who, like Selleck, plays a confident advertising executive. Unfortunately, the producers of The Closer got everything right but the writing. The dialogue is so stiff and predictable, it drains most of the fun out of watching Asner and Selleck share the same stage.
So the shark is moving forward. You should know that everyone out there, including me in here, was let go.
Hey, Carl. This is advertising. We get fired, we go to rival firms, we get higher paying jobs and steal the clients from the agencies that fired us. That's what we do.
No, that's what you and I do. What about them, the three B's? Beverly, Bruno, New Barbara.
I don't even know New Barbara.
Then you don't know that the New York guys banished her here. It's not gonna be easy for her to find a job.
Really, the New York guys didn't like her. She must be good.
That's what I'm saying. What are we going to do for these good people out here?
Listen, I'm sure you're all feeling... Well, I really don't have a clue what you're all feeling. But know this. By the end of business tomorrow, I will have a new job. And I just want to say to all of you, feel free to steal as many office supplies as you can get your hands on.
Four Corners, which teams Anne Margaret and Kiss of the Spider-Woman star Sonia Braga, is another new CBS series that doesn't start out as strongly as it should. It comes from the creators of Dallas and is in that same kind of vein, a big, sprawling soap opera with Anne Margaret as the matriarch of a modern ranch. Like The Closer, it's got a fine supporting cast. Megan Ward, who plays Anne Margaret's fiery daughter, steals every scene she's in and is great to watch. Too many times, though, the fun just isn't there, and the dialogue in Four Corners sounds like it's being read and recited rather than acted. Here's one of the better scenes, between Anne Margaret and Douglas West, who plays her son. But even here, The lines are somewhat harsh and stilted.
Mother, please.
Don't think I can talk to you yet.
Oh, what should I do then, right? Facts.
Excuse me.
Come on, just
excuse
come back
me
to the lodge. Come back to my
no,
office
no, no,
and we'll talk about
that.
Well,
right?
Maybe I have something to say to
I'm
you.
Sure
did
you
ever
do
think
get
of that?
Out of my
mother,
way.
Mother.
You lied to me. You betrayed our family, Alex.
Of course I lied to you. I always lie to you. You make me lie to you.
That's ridiculous.
Do you know something? Do you know something?
What?
I have no choice but to lie to you. Look at the lodge. I had to beg you to build it. Told you we're going to keep it to 12 rooms, knowing the whole time we're going to build 48. I lied to you every step of the way. And you know what? The lodge saved the ranch, Mother. The ranch barely pays for itself in a good year. And after the drought, we definitely would have lost it, except for the lodge, which you still hate. Sure, I lie to you all the time. I betray you left and right, and I feel terrible doing it. But I have to, in order to save your precious ranch. And you never say thank you. You never once said thank you.
So much is riding on both of these series, from the standpoint of both CBS and the stars involved, that I just don't understand why they didn't hold out for more polished scripts. Tom Selleck and Anne Margaret may bring people to the set the first time, but only decent scripts can keep them there. I'm disappointed in both of these new shows, but I'm not dismissing either of them. Not yet. And the only reason I'm not is because of their stars, who may be just as disappointed in the initial efforts as I am. They may change things. All we can do, if they don't, is change channels.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Roberta Shorrock directs Fresh Air. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let's end the show with one more from the king of one-liners, Henny Youngman.
In love with one woman 49 years. My wife finds out, she'd kill me. People ask, how did it last so long? Here's the secret. My wife and I go to a lovely restaurant like this twice a week. A little candlelight, a little wine. She goes Tuesdays, I go Fridays. I said, where do you want to go for your anniversary? She said, I want to go somewhere I've never been before. I said, try the kitchen. She lost all the credit cards. I'm not going to report it. Why should I? One of founders spends less than she does. She will buy anything marked down. Last week, she brought home an escalator.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.